Who are you?
So I'm Tim Smeeth. I'm a Windows Presentation Foundation evangelist, and my role is basically to go and tell the world about how cool Avalon is and some of the associated sort of features around that.
Now, on previous videos, I took some heck from channel liners. Why do I have evangelists showing me around? One of the reasons is you have relationships with the teams that I don't have.
Right.
And two, you know what you're talking about.
I'll take the former. I'm not sure about the latter. But I mean, one of the things that we try and do is to try and work with the product groups, work with marketing, and trying to establish, you know, what are the features that people actually are keen to use, try to work with early adopters. So we have a tap program, for example, where we have, you know, 20-odd customers that are all building early application. So
right.
Here we're talking to here in building two, we're in the Windows printing area, and we've got
and that's probably why there's all these printers.
Yeah,
right,
there's,
huh?
There's a ton of printers here, and we're going to see a good few of them in a little while. So I mean, the whole purpose of this area here is to really drive print innovation, which on the surface, I mean, seems like a bit of a dull area, right? I mean, you know, printers, you know, that's just like sort of one of the stock issues, right? I mean, you can't do 3D, you can't do animation, none of the sexy things that supposedly Avalon is all about. But actually, I think when you see some of the stuff that we've been sort of working on, these team have been working on for the last few years.
So we still haven't figured out how to make a paperless office yet?
Is that what this whole trick is about? Scenario where we're sort of, you know, there's still plenty of paper floating around. And I think one of the big problems is today, you know, the whole paper print path is just not very good quality. You know, some of the stuff that people print doesn't look like it looks on screen, and so there's a lot of work that this team here are doing to really make it possible not just to build better print drivers and build applications that output better, but also to really build in a kind of like a streamlined workflow process right through from the Avalon kind of graphics subsystem right through down to the printer. It's a bit like the old days when you know, we used to have sort of LPs or records, and you know, the whole digital process has been gradually trying to drive digital right the way down to the final device. You know, one day perhaps we'll have digital speakers and we'll do the kind of digital analog sort of decoding there. But similarly, in this kind of world here, we're really trying to move forward and you know, take Avalon right the way down.
Today we're going to meet the whole team, or most of the
team? I think
we're
going to meet like four or five people.
Okay.
So, and in fact, the first one is just here. This is Oliver Furr, who's an architect on the team here.
So tell me about printing in Windows Vista and why it's going to be so much better than what we have. And first of all, does it really suck that bad today? I print out a lot of stuff and it seems to work pretty well.
It depends on what you do, yes.
Okay.
So if you just do plain black and white text printing, that works pretty well. But as soon as you get into advanced graphics, which become more and more common, like transparencies and gradients, you will find that existing print technologies either print that terribly slow because they have to pre-raster the whole page, or they just have to compromise in the quality of the output. And so what we did in XPS, which stands for XML paper specification, we took a look at the Windows Presentation Foundation graphics model,
mm-hmm.
and took a subset of the operators that are available there, and we selected that subset in a way that is sufficient to express all the static graphics that you can have in the Windows Presentation Foundation, but at the same time is very closely defined and very well defined, and it's a small subset. And one of the reasons why we went down that road is that we want to actually from Windows Vista, we want to reach out to the peripheral. We want to make the peripheral a part of the document lifecycle. And a lot of the peripherals that are out there in the market and that are going to be developed, of course, don't run Windows.
Yep.
They have some embedded controller, maybe running.
Yeah, like this doesn't run.
For example, this one here. It's a device developed by engineers from Fuji Xerox, and they've been a very early adopter of the XPS technology. And they've
now, first of all, XPS. Do I need a new application to use XPS, or is it What does it look like to my mom and dad, when they get Windows Vista?
If you get Windows Vista, you will have fewer 4XPS integrated with Windows Vista.
Okay.
So if you basically double-click on an XPS document, the experience will be seamless. The viewer pops up, you can read the document, you can leaf through the pages, it will have hyperlinks and all the common experience for static documents.
Okay.
There will also be a driver component that allows you to create XPS documents from all your standard applications. For example, from Microsoft Office or also from existing other applications, you can actually save two XPS documents, and then those documents take part in the document lifecycle.
Okay.
And you can exchange them with other people. You can actually add digital rights management to those documents and control what other people can do with those documents, if they can print those or view those or where the documents can go. And the interesting feature of the one interesting part of the technology is that the XPS format is also the native spool format for Windows Presentation Foundation applications.
Okay.
So that essentially means if you write a WPF application and you print, there's no translation step from the application to the device if the device supports XPS. And that's one of the main advantages over existing technologies that require a driver on the front end which translates it into some PDL from potentially from GDI. It first goes into EMF, and there is already some loss of fidelity there in some cases, and then it's translated again into PostScript or PCL with another loss of fidelity.
Oh, wow.
And We avoid these intermediate translation steps.
Okay.
And you've got some printouts, haven't you?
Yes. To show you what I'm talking about, actually, we have it's one of Bill Gates's presentations that he created a while ago.
Yeah.
And if you look at this on the right, this is what you would get with a traditional PostScript printer.
So the cutouts are strict.
What you see, the cutouts are very strict.
Whereas here they
you have transparency exactly like on screen. Another
now, this
example.
We just printed this a couple of minutes ago on a regular PostScript printer.
Yes.
Right?
So that's the standard of technology that ships today.
And so go back to the new one.
Okay.
The new one printed on this printer here.
Yes, that printed on this printer.
Now I need an XPS printer to get this kind of quality, right?
I
wouldn't get this just by printing an XPS document on an old
PostScript. Yes, actually, you will get certain advantages even if you print it on a PostScript printer.
Oh, really?
Because there are some specific translation and driver components that we built with Windows Vista that actually will give you some better fidelity experience than with straight PostScript today.
Okay.
It won't be on par with a pure XPS printer, but it will be better than what you know from.
So just by buying Windows Vista, I'm going to get better printouts.
Yes, we think so.
That's a powerful story right there. And then if you get a new XPS capable printer, is there going to be a logo on the printers when you go to buy a new printer or something like that? Or?
No.
Okay.
So it will be a seamless experience, and it will be just to the end user, it will look like a printer, like any other printer.
Okay.
So Oliver, I mean, apart from that one, I mean, you saw there was some fading or blurring there.
Yes.
What are the kind of improvements you get with XPS? What other things does it bring?
So
here's the old one.
So this is the old one. This is the new one. XPS is much more powerful in expressing especially gradients and transparent effects, which results in much smaller spool file size. So the document file size the spool file size that you would get to print a page like this goes from multi-megabytes down to several hundred K.
That's pretty cool.
While this might take 2 to 5 minutes to print, this would take
these pages
a
just
few seconds.
Fly out of this device at engine speed.
Okay.
And so we've had this cooperation with Fuji Xerox where they basically took our early versions of the XPS spec and they started they basically ripped it out of our hands, and then they were so excited they started developing based on that spec and always kept abreast with our latest developments. And this is basically their prototype device.
Yeah.
And this device not only shows the printing capabilities of XPS, but another very interesting feature. I said in the beginning that XPS allows us to integrate devices more into the whole document lifecycle. And what this device is, it's a so-called MFP, a multifunction peripheral,
mm-hmm.
that not only can print, but it's also a scanner.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is XPS has a feature or supports digital signatures. And the Fuji Xerox engineers have actually incorporated that technology in this device. So if I can show you this
sure.
on the front panel,
yeah.
You can go to scanning mode.
Yep.
And here you can see it says format XPS with digital signature.
Yep.
And now I have this IC card, which is my personal signature, which I can use to identify myself. And I have this card reader back here.
Yep.
And once I approach
like an RFID
this, it's an RFID card. It basically it locks me in with my signature, and this indicator light here jumps to the locked in state.
Yep.
And this device now is ready to encrypt the document and sign it with my personal digital signature and either email it to my mailbox or to a distribution list or put it on a share on the server. But all this, of course, in a secure way. And
that's not possible with the TIFF or the standard types of scans that were done before? Or?
We are not aware of existing solutions that allow you to do that.
Okay.
Now, is this the only printer that you can do this kind of stuff with, or are there other manufacturers that are working on XPS devices?
We have a number of manufacturers who are working on prototypes. It just happens that the Fuji Xerox guys were the first and fastest. They were really amazing around this whole technology. We have, of course, other major, basically all major printer manufacturers are working on the technology today.
Yeah. Now the print file, it's a both a file format and as well as something that goes to the printer, right? XPS.
Yes.
Can I do both at one with one operation? Can I go print and have it saved to a file
sure.
and send it
sure.
to my printer?
That's the beauty of the format. So we have also along with the new print subsystem on Windows Vista, we have what we call a filter pipeline, and which integrates with the whole workflow. And one of the filters that you could implement is actually a filter used for archival, document archival. So we can now implement a workflow solution where once you print, you immediately also archive the same document that was sent to the printer. And you can then view that document with your integrated viewer in Windows Vista.
Okay.
And another thing that's important to mention about XPS, as the name says, XML paper specification.
Yeah.
All the markup in XPS is XML. It's basically a subset of SAML, also used by the Presentation Foundation. And the container in which we store that XML that describes the document is a standard ZIP container.
ZIP file.
Yes,
so you can open.
File.
You can just open it up in the in Explorer and look at the file. Right?
Exactly. Exactly, and the main benefit of that is that more and more government organizations are setting forth requirements for document lifecycle and document lifetime, which require that the document format is not proprietary or binary, because
yeah.
as you know, 20 years from now, who knows what we might have on our desktops.
Yeah.
And sometimes applications, they get lost. For example, today you might not be able to open an old WordPerfect file anymore because it's a proprietary format. Only the application understood it. The application is not around anymore.
Now, I bet you're more excited about the developer implications of having an open XML file format, because now any developer in the world can build a application that can open up an XPS document and display it
yeah.
and print back out to it. Right?
Absolutely, and that kind of workflow piece is really sort of interesting, because the way that the XPS sort of format is set up is such that you have like this extensible kind of header, so you know, you can add signatures, you can add rights management if you want. You know, let's say you're a journal, an academic journal, and you want to kind of be able to distribute this stuff in a kind of protected way. If you want to be able to to go ahead and add just these workflow steps. You know, you can imagine this with Windows Workflow Foundation, which is all the really cool stuff that is around sort of driving workflow processes, and you could really build a cool solution there. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we have four other people to see, right?
Okay.
Thank you very much for
you're welcome.
Demo. This is cool stuff, and we're looking forward to seeing more devices.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you.
Cool.
So we're off to see Adrian, who is just down here, actually. Not too far. Adrian, hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
So we're just wandering
around
the halls.
Let me get on that side of you. Sorry.
You go that way. And we're just really trying to sort of, you know, find out from people what they're working on, what they're building, and, you know,
okay.
why it's interesting. So
close this so we don't disturb too many people.
Okay. So what do you do?
I work on setup for printers, which is a much bigger area than it sounds.
So, I mean, setup just sounds like something where, you know, you just hit the button, you know, you pick your printer and away you go. So,
right,
so what's so complex?
So what's so complex is the interop, actually. So we've got, if you think about a 32-bit print server running Windows 2003, think of all the different clients that it might have to talk to. In fact, on Windows 2003, we still supported Windows 98 clients.
Mm-hmm.
So the driver model is very different, so there's questions about how do you get a trusted Windows 98 driver onto a Windows 2003 server. How do you then get that down onto the correct client? But then you might have a 64-bit client connecting. How do you tell the difference between those two clients? So it's all just the interop issues are really very interesting. There's a level of complexity that that the driver developer has to think about. How do they, for example, author their drivers so that they can run on different operating systems? We support a driver model that allows the driver to run anywhere from Windows 2000 with the one driver model, from Windows 2000 up to Vista. So if you've got something like the new XPS printers that you see over there, how do you offer a driver so that it can understand, you know, so they can interoperate with XPS drivers and still work down a level. So
right.
There's a whole lot of complexity there, but you know, printing's kind of like plumbing, as one of the developers here says. You know, setup is like plumbing, especially. It's like it should all work, but people only really miss it when it doesn't.
Right.
So, like you say, you should be able to click the button and everything should just work, but all that complexity should be hidden underneath the surface, and I like to think that it is.
Right.
So, so really, you know, if nothing happens in Vista regarding setup, then I've done a good job. It's an interesting
thing.
But we do have some things that are noticeable and that users are going to appreciate coming in Vista, so I can talk about some of those if you're interested.
Please.
One of the I think one of the really important and exciting changes is it's been spurred by the UAP initiative, the user account protection system. So
that's where like when you're sort of logged in as an administrator now, you don't actually appear as an administrator, right? You have this reduced kind of level of privileges.
And have you ever run as a standard user?
Very rarely.
Okay.
Lasted about 30 seconds, mostly.
Well, I used to run as a standard user in the previous days all the time.
Right.
And it was very painful, and I could really, honestly, I could only do it because I had multiple machines.
Right.
So if I needed something done, I'd go over to the other machine and do that. And now, of course, with Vista, it effectively, as you say, everyone is a standard user.
So they don't have admin rights.
They don't have admin rights by default, but you can elevate. There's an elevation process that you can go through to get those admin rights. So we had that situation in Vista, and then we have a lot of customers, corporate customers, who are running managed environments,
mm-hmm.
and one of the common things they have to do is to have their people install printers. So someone calls up the help desk and says, I just bought a new inkjet printer for my little work group. I need to install the driver for it. Can I do it? And they're not an admin. And so someone from help desk has to physically go out there usually and install, you know, elevate, log in as admin, install the driver. And that costs them money. And that adds up to a lot of money.
Right.
And or the other thing that some places do is they tell the person the admin password and let them install the driver themselves, but at that point you've lost control and
right.
it's costing you money again. So we have a lot of customers who are really interested in a way for us to provide a way to install a printer driver under certain control conditions. So what we did was we looked at UAP, we looked at this requirement, and so we've implemented a system whereby normal standard users, anyone can install a printer driver so long as they're physically at the device. Now, obviously, there's a concern there. Like, you don't want people logging into terminal servers and installing 4,000 printers, which is what we've got in the box.
Right.
So we don't allow that. But if you're physically at the device, then sure, why not? Why shouldn't you be able to install a driver that's already in box? Just go ahead and do it. Then the other thing is that if you want to introduce a new driver to the system, you think about that. A new driver could be a security problem. But if you say, well, I trust printer drivers. Let's say I trust printer drivers from a certain manufacturer. Then what we do is we allow an admin to say, using group policy, that all of the people in this particular group, in this, let's say in my domain, can install drivers that are signed and verified as print drivers, let's say signed by some well-known manufacturer, and that are printer drivers, as I said. So then they specify that in group policy, and standard user can then install just that particular type of driver onto the system.
Right.
So it's very controlled.
So it sounds like a big challenge here is just the whole kind of compatibility sort of thing there, that you've got these printer drivers that might have been around for a while, and you're trying to, like a lot of the thing, problems people in the UAP team are kind of trying to resolve, it's how you maintain security whilst not breaking that sort of
security thing is really the big concern there.
Right.
And it's really about providing a controlled and simple way for the administrator to understand, to delegate that right.
Can I just have you turn off your monitors because the bright background? There you go. Okay. It makes it a lot easier to see your face. Sorry.
Sure. She's always good.
Maybe. Now, the key issue is you are giving away a little bit of security there because you're allowing people to introduce a new device onto the system. So you want to do it in a very, very controlled way.
Right.
So the device driver, it's got to be trusted by somebody. So the approach we took was the domain admin is the person who really is responsible for determining whether someone can do this or not. So they should be making that trust decision.
Right.
So what they can do, I think in the ideal scenario, is what they'll do is they will say, I sign this driver with a signature that I get from VeriSign that identifies my organization. Right, so we're going to give them some tools so that they can sign it with their own signature. So they'll say, I'm Acme Inc. and I sign this driver as Acme.
Right.
And I allow everyone in my organization to install drivers that are signed by Acme. So they can make that blanket statement, and that's pretty good control. Or they can say, I allow everyone in my organization to install drivers that are signed by Acme and that are printer drivers, but not, I don't allow them to install, let's say, any drivers that are flash card or flash memory or removable storage drivers.
Right.
So there you've got quite a secure system. People can install printer drivers, but they can't install removable media and take information off the system and so forth. So you can see the level of granularity that's going on. We actually let you specify it all the way down to things like the plug-and-play ID level. So if you know a particular set of devices is causing you problems, you can just block out those particular devices. Mm. So it's pretty granular.
And that's all done via group policy, basically, so you can configure it by the
exadration.
Yeah,
it's pretty neat. That's in the builds. That'll be in beta 2.
Okay.
I've been using it quite a bit over the past couple of weeks, and it works pretty well. It's a nice system.
So your team's basically responsible for the print infrastructure that kind of goes in there, and so you're checking in sort of regularly into Vista. And are you kind of more or less feature complete? Where are you in terms of
Vista? We are feature complete.
Vista?
Yes.
Wow.
So right now, especially with UAP, there's a lot of fit and finish type of stuff. So right now, what we're doing is we're going through all of the corner case scenarios. So it's like, yes, someone can install a printer driver as a standard user, and we've got to check that they can't do it on the terminal server, and we've got to check they can't do it from the guest account, and we're trying all these different weird things to see whether, you know, if you go through a terminal server and our guest account, did we miss something in the logic? You know, there's a lot of things that we're just trying right now.
Cool.
And we have to do a lot of runs with third-party drivers, so we're going to be downloading or obtaining a lot of third-party drivers from the leading vendors, and we'll just try those and make sure that they all work properly.
Right.
So for the next year, just roll through, test.
So people can get your bits. I mean, the next CTP, I think we've got another CTP coming soon, and Beta 2 will have bits that people can test, which will be the real stuff. Yes. And I think we're going to go and see your lab in a minute. I think we're going to see some of the servers where you do some stress tests.
Okay, are you going to see John? Cool. Or
we're going to go and see John Clavin now.
Clavin, yeah.
Clavin, over in the... So.
You'll notice that this group's kind of Irish heavy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What's up with that?
You recruit the best.
And Bill,
right?
Bill Hill is Bill Hill is Scottish. It's like everybody who's done something visual is Scottish or Irish.
We're a little different. I'm from Belfast and John's from Dublin.
Oh,
so
okay.
We're a little
so they keep you two separated
there.
By at least a couple of offices there.
Right.
Exactly. Cool, we better go and see him.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's been nice to meet you.
You too.
So John, I think, sort of does a lot of the kind of 64-bit driver stuff. So he's hopefully going to be able to tell us a little bit about 64-bit drivers, whether they work, what you've got to do. Because I know that one of the problems that a lot of people have found with 64-bit stuff is just incompatibility with driver stuff. So this is John. So
hey, how are you doing?
Hey,
John, tell us a little bit about what your focus is. I see you just have like a cinematic display of Windows XP 64-bit. You're trying to tell us something here.
I'm going to tell you that Windows XP 64-bit is one of the greatest operating systems that I've ever used at this company. It is so absolutely fantastic.
What makes it so good?
It's a couple of things that really make it fantastic. One of them is the simple fact that you've got so much more processing power available. If you want to consider 32-bit Windows and 64-bit Windows in terms of a highway, you're moving from a two-lane highway to a four-lane highway in terms of the amount of data that you can move through the computer at a given time. And that makes processor-intensive applications such as photo editing, compiling, number crunching happen so much faster that anybody who's using these computers in a professional environment can do their work in a much faster way.
Now, does it speed up existing apps? Like, if I have Photoshop, does Photoshop all of a sudden get faster if I get a 64-bit processor?
So, one of the key things that you need to have with 64-bit computers is that the current generation of 64-bit operating systems, which is Windows for X64 systems, will support standard 32-bit or old-style applications as well as the new-style 64-bit apps. In order to really take advantage of the 64-bit capabilities of the new operating system, you do need to have a 64-bit application. But one of the things that we're discovering is that even for a 32-bit application, which is compatible and runs through a compatibility layer on the 64-bit OS, many of those do run faster simply through the extra data processing. So you've got, if you like, a three-stage approach. You've got 32-bit app on a 32-bit operating system, runs at the standard speed that people have today. You've got a 32-bit app running on a 64-bit OS, it runs a bit faster, particularly in the areas of number crunching and data delivery, etc. And if you've got a 64-bit app running on a 64-bit operating system, it runs a lot faster.
Okay. And now, if I update my processor to 64-bit, do I need new drivers?
This is one of the most difficult areas that you've got a lot of confusion, that if you have a 64-bit processor in your computer, you can run the 32-bit version of Windows, provided it's the x86 or the x64 processor. It's better in terms of speed if you run the x64 version of Windows, but the difficulty is the amount of applications and drivers that are available do mean that you need to make an educated choice about what's right for you at the moment. Okay. The x64 technology is a newer technology. Drivers are slightly slow to catch up, and you do have to have a 64-bit driver for your device. So if you've got a printer or a network card or a video card, you do need to have a 64-bit driver. So it's good to do the research beforehand just to make sure that your technology is supported with the operating system. Now, from the digital documents team perspective, as far as print
drivers... Is there a list, by the way, where I can go and check to make sure my video card and my keyboard and my... all my other stuff works, has 64-bit drivers available.
So there are two places that you can go look. One is what's supported in the box natively, so what's shipped inside the package. Okay. And you can see lists of those. There are various online places. For the Windows Hardware Qualification Labs, which is where devices that ship after the operating system can get certified and signed with Microsoft drivers, if you go to www.microsoft.com/HCL, you'll see a list there for Windows XP for X64 that will show you what devices are compatible.
And also, is there a difference between AMD's 64-bit and Intel's 64-bit? I'm a little bit... heard a lot about two different flavors or something like that.
So if you're a processor engineer, there's a bunch of difference. If you're just an ordinary guy like you or I who's trying to use the OS, it's the same thing. So the operating system abstracts the difference between Intel's x64 and AMD's x64 so that you, as a user, see exactly the same thing.
Okay.
Now, there is one complication in that there is another flavor of 64-bit, which is the Itanium processors, aimed at much higher end. They also run Windows, but it's data center, server, enterprise center, really highly scalable applications, not something that your regular consumer or power user would be using.
So I mean, you work in the print team here, right?
Correct.
Are you a program manager? What's your role here?
So I'm the lead program manager in the printing and imaging team with responsibility for driver development, 64-bit, and developer interactions with our hardware partners. So, for example, if we're working with a new operating system, as we're doing now with Windows Vista, we want to have the latest drivers that are included in it for all of our products. So I work with the main manufacturers, Hewlett-Packard, Epson, Canon, Xerox, etc.,
right,
to develop their drivers to work with the new operating system, to take advantage of the new features that you've been hearing about already today, and bundle their drivers inside the operating system so that when you get your copy of Windows, it will have the latest, greatest driver for your printer already included in the operating system. And then, once we've shipped the operating system, the goal is that everybody is committed to the same type of technology. So there's a very easy path to get drivers on Windows Update, Microsoft Update, the IHV's website included in the box, all using the same technology. So we don't have what we had in the past of this driver incompatibility. I have the driver from HP. Is it the same one as the driver from Windows, or the same one as the driver from driverstore.com?
Right.
So the whole goal is to make a community effort to work together to develop a single driver for each device that will be distributable in all the places that people know to look for drivers.
Okay. So what is the 64-bit story on the print side then? I mean, we talked about how challenging it sometimes is to find the right 64-bit drivers. I know a few guys who are still running 32-bit Windows just waiting for a little bit better sort of support. What's the print story like? Is it really difficult?
The story is generally quite good, in the context of it being a first version of consumer-oriented 64-bit operating system. Within the box, as it ships today, there are something in the region of 6,000 64-bit print drivers that address a wide range from the cheapest consumer inkjet to the very large-end $20,000 professional print devices.
Now, are they all native 64-bit print drivers, or some of those sort of 32-bit print drivers have been kind of like certified in a 64-bit environment?
No, so they're all native 64-bit drivers that are included with the product. You must be a native 64-bit driver in order to run naturally on the product.
Uh-huh.
There's also an additional series of drivers that have been through hardware certification, so they've got the Design for Windows logo and are available from Microsoft.com, HCL as downloads, or from the vendor websites, etc. As the product's been in the shelves for about 6 months or so, the amount of drivers that are available on those third-party websites that are 64-bit aware is reasonably small and tends to represent the top-selling devices at the moment in the segments where 64-bit operating systems are a requirement. So there's a lot of CAD/CAMs, computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacture, some gamers and some photo-intensive use. So you've got a lot of photo printers, a lot of design printers with a wide format, plotters, etc., have been the first set of devices where there was a real business need to be developed. And that's really one of the key things, is that our development partners in the major print manufacturers, they have their marketing needs as well. They want to develop what's most required by the industry. And for the starting process, they've gone, well, this device is going to be needed in a 64-bit environment, so we'll develop this first. When we get Windows Vista out in the near future, then we will see virtual parity in the 32-bit and 64-bit flavors of the drivers being available.
Right. Now, we were right at the start of this interview, we were over with the printer side, and we were seeing a Xerox XPS printer.
Correct.
And we were talking about how this XPS sort of thing is gradually sort of going down into the printer. I mean, what is the XPS story for print drivers? Do people need to rewrite their print drivers? And does it only matter if they've got an XPS printer? How does that work?
Well, so there's two sides to XPS, as I'm sure that Oliver explained a few minutes ago. You've got an XPS native consuming device, so you just generate an XPS document and pass that directly to the device, or you can have a device driver do some conversion for you. If you're doing the native pass-through, there's no work required. If you're doing the conversion, which is in effect a print driver, then you will need to have a 64-bit version of that driver.
Right.
Now, from a development perspective, the good thing is that 64-bit and 32-bit, at least from the x86 and the x64 perspective, are virtually source compatible. So you write your source once and you just compile it in a different way for either architecture. So there's a little bit more test work involved at the end because you've got to test two sets of binaries, mm-hmm. but the actual development work, which is the bulk of the effort involved in creating a driver, is virtually the same, maybe
right.
you 2% longer to generate two flavors.
And is there like one place, you mentioned the HCL site, but is there one place you'd point like developers to who are kind of looking at this kind of stuff? Where is there like a Microsoft site or something?
So there's a series of documentation available on the MSDN website about porting drivers to 64-bit, and there's documentation up there about porting, printing and imaging drivers to 64-bit in particular. And some of the things that developers will need to pay attention to is that while the functionality is exactly the same at the end, there are some different ways that you can reach the functionality, and there are some API calls that function in a slightly different way because we've got 32-bit apps on a 64-bit OS, so we've got to change the size of the incoming data from 32 bits wide to 64 bits wide, and there's some translation that has to happen, and some of the API sets function in a slightly different way. So while you can write drivers that do them the full way, if you've taken advantage of one of these APIs, you may need to refactor the driver a little bit to function the same way in this cross-architecture environment.
Right. Cool. Thank you very much. It's been great.
Yeah.
We need
Thank
to
really great.
Go on, because I know that time is running out. And
yep.
We're going to head off to the hardware lab. This is Bertus, who...
Hey,
do you run the lab? Bertus, what's your role?
No, I'm actually one of the test leads on the team.
Okay.
And I mostly write and create tests,
uh-huh.
but I do work with the coordination of the team.
Okay.
And the first place I'm going to show you is our automation lab. So this is where we run all our automated tests.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, so that's your automation lab?
Yep.
What's that virtual Adam? What's that all about?
You can tell you're in a lab because it's noisy.
Oh, that's an old building. It's
right.
A little bit noisy in here.
All right.
So we've got about 300 machines in here, and they're all on a test automation harness system. And
right.
We dynamically grab them out of the pool, and we can configure them as clients, as servers. And this is where we basically do all the testing that doesn't require actual physical output.
Right.
So.
Let me just get a look around, and then we can talk out
sure.
in the hall, because it's a little noisy. So these are all servers that you're actually testing principlers
on? They can be clients or servers. So they could be actual servers, or they are the clients that print to the servers
right.
at any particular time.
Let's just get a look around here.
We've got some big iron over here.
Yeah, and then you have more machines over here as well.
Yeah, we got a few big printers over here that are on the network.
Yeah.
So tell us a little
and a
bit
big
about,
and a big power supply.
Oh, wow. And lots of cooling.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how you set up these machines. I mean, you run some kind of
so
automated stuff on them.
They're all on automation harness, and what happens is that they're in this machine pool.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can do is basically from our offices schedule test jobs, and we can make them grab a machine, say configure this machine, install the latest build on it. It's now a server. Configure some printers on it, and then also we can change it to say. Grab another few machines, their clients, run the following jobs against them, test specific functionality in the print subsystem.
Right.
And it's a pretty flexible and powerful system.
And so, I mean, you're like installing as many, in many cases, you're trying to see how many print drivers you can install on the machine or how much throughput you can put through. What kind of tests do you do?
We have in excess of 100,000 test cases that we run in here.
Wow.
So, and you will, some of the other machines that are in here are stress servers. So basically, you guys probably heard about anti-stress. When stress runs in the company at night, a lot of the tasks that they do is they work with print servers as well. So these servers act as the targets of that stress clients. And you know, we will remotely debug them and figure out problems and see if they can handle the load and that kind of stuff.
Yes, stress. So stress. I know you're running stress. Stress is run on a lot of employees' computers around campus here.
Yeah.
And they run an automated test suite that just hits and pounds both the client system and as well as your print servers.
Yes. Anybody in the Windows team can run client stress when they go home every night. And some nights we see an excess of 1,000 clients coming in and hitting a print server. So often, you know, at the end of a product cycle, as we're pushing for beta, we'll see 2,000, 3,000 clients getting in there and really hammering the servers.
Very cool.
That's pretty cool.
Awesome.
Thanks.
So you're going to take us also and show us some of your prints hardware
yeah.
labs. It's in the print it themselves, right?
Yeah, I'm going to show you where we do some output testing. So just around the corner here.
Now, how many printers do we actually test on here? I mean, you know, how many different...
We aim to test the top 95% of the installed market, and we have various ways of figuring out which devices those are.
Okay.
We look at consumable numbers that are being, consumables like over here. This is where we keep all our ink and our...
So if I ever need an inkjet, ink cartridge, I know where to come now.
Yeah, that's why we have a lock on the door. And so these devices over here, some of them are plugged in, some of them are just in storage. You can see here's an old antique dot matrix printer.
Yeah.
Still surprisingly popular for printing statements and that kind of stuff, and so we test it and make sure it works well.
Wow.
You kind of walk through here, you'll see...
Yeah, you see some old printers here. And
some old ones, some new ones. You'll see several of them are plugged in and hooked up to the network. They're all on a print server that people can print to check if the specific...
How many different printers do you have in these labs?
In this lab, depending on the time, we'll have between 300 and 600.
300.
But we have a big storage room on another part of campus where we have many, many more. As we get into the betas, you know, customers report problems and you need that specific printer to check out if you can repro the problem and maybe get a fix if there's a problem.
Interesting.
We've got a guy that specializes in buying old printers off eBay because printers
Good way to bump up your eBay rating on the work time.
Well, you know, like some of the consumer printers, they aren't sold for a very long time. So if you need to find one to get a repro, you can't just go out to an office supply store and buy one. You actually got to go look for a secondhand one. So we sometimes do that stuff depending on how big the problem is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you test scanners too, right?
Yeah, our team actually does printer scanners, and we have some, you know, guys that do fax as well. So this is our wall of scanners.
Yeah, let me just look.
They're more compact than printers, so you can store them a little bit more densely.
Wall-to-wall scanners.
So, I mean, your goal is what, to test all of these through the Vista cycle, or how do you kind of... Because you can't easily automate this in the same way as you can
it's a big problem. You can't really automate this in the same way. So we have... We did these market studies that I was talking about, and we decided, okay, these models cover the top 95% of the market, and that comes out to, I think, like 300 and something printers. And so we test those fairly regularly. But then we do have contracts with testing companies where they test a bigger set of the printers out there. And we all also have a very close relationship with the printer vendors. So most of them are actually on site, and they bring their own printers, and we make builds, you know, daily builds available to them, and they test the devices that they care about. So it's kind of we've got several approaches to the problem, several different people tackling it from different areas. This lab specifically basically just tests the most popular printers on pretty much every build.
Wow.
So did you say how many printers you've got in total? I mean, do you have any rough idea of those kind of things?
I don't know. Several thousand at least.
Right.
But, you know, like the less popular ones don't get printed too as often as basically.
Right. So when a test suite is running, what would this room sound like? Just going constantly.
It's not like the old days where the printers are as noisy as they used to be. It doesn't get that bad in here.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of the bigger printers are not physically in this room. Because they take so much space, they're actually in people's offices around the building.
Right.
And but they're hooked up to the network, because these are typically the more like work group type printers. So people from here will schedule a test on it and then walk into some guy's office and grab the paper output and inspect it and see that it's all good.
So no queues for a particular printer here. You've got sort of plenty of choices on the Active Directory to kind of go and find a printer.
Finding storage for all of them is always a challenge. Yeah. So we keep a database of who's got the printer, in which office this model of printer is. And people, developers will come in here and check out a printer to work with, and then...
I want to know what kind of printer is this.
that's
USB connected, or is it the cable?
Somebody's a guitar fan, huh?
Extraordinary good sound in that printer, yes.
Yeah.
And you've got a really big one. I walked past this one and I thought this was like some kind of photo preview monitor, but I think it just turns out to be like an aquarium.
Yeah, this is a pretty nice HP. Well, I guess you would call it a plotter, although these days they're not really plotters anymore. They're just wide inkjet printers.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's got the roll on that is just huge.
Yeah, so can we come and print out our posters here?
Yeah.
We do get requests, and we do help people print out really large pictures.
Excellent.
These aren't that common, so.
No.
Great. See you coming.
Little secrets of Microsoft. Where to go to get your posters printed?
This one is actually on the network. Get access.
You shouldn't have told everybody.
Well, you didn't get the name.
yeah,
But we know your name.
Probably access controlled, you know, so.
Yeah, that's true.
See if I can open the door backwards.
All right.
So we're going to go and see Michael
Burgoyne.
So you take us to his office, because I...
The building can be a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
So here's Michael.
Here we are. There. So you can tell this is the office of somebody who's interested in colour spaces and things, I guess, because we've got a looks much brighter, nice natural light than you've got in full spectrum
tubes. Who are you, by the way? Who are you?
I'm Lavanya. Yes. Who are you?
And Robert Scoville from Channel 9. So we're doing
wow.
live video.
Cool.
And what do you do here?
I'm a PM with the color team.
Excellent. So that's why you're talking to the color.
Yes.
Cool.
We're collaborating. This is Lavanya Vasudevan, one of my colleagues, PM in the color team.
Very cool.
And I'm Michael Burgoyne. I'm program manager in the Digital Documents Platforms and Solutions D2 color team.
Excellent. Let me
so
get
tell
closer.
Us a little bit about what you do. What does color mean in this context?
The D2 color team has responsibility for the color in Windows. And going forward, in particular in Windows Vista, we have responsibility for the Windows color system, which is the new color management infrastructure that we're putting in Vista.
So there's a big announcement with Canon about that, right? Just a couple of weeks ago that we talked a little bit about
Canon
a partnership.
Expo.
So can you just explain very simply what Windows Color System is? What's that announcement all about?
Well, the Windows Color System is a new color management architecture. Most existing color management systems are based on the ICC, International Color Consortium, Color Profile Standard. And that model uses what we call a smart profile, simple CMM. The CMM is the color management engine. So basically all of the smarts are baked into color profile. The model that we're using breaks that up. The result of that is that the color profiles tend to be a black box. Once you've got them, there's very little you can do with them and very little you can do to evaluate the processing that happens in them. In the Windows color system, we're breaking up that what's baked into ICC profiles into a series of discrete stages. And our profiles that Windows color system profiles are just raw measurement data embodied in XML. They're very simple to make, they're very easy to read, and then it's very easy to evaluate the processing at stages through the color processing pipeline and see if the color's not coming out right, which stage is at fault.
Right.
And we also have broken out where the gamut mapping operation, which is a mapping from one color space, one device color space, into another device's color space, where that's baked into an ICC profile, we've broken that out, and we have separate explicit gamut mapping operations.
Now, you're using this gamut word, can you just sort of explain what you mean by gamut?
In general, a gamut, color devices have, if you look at this is a Monaco Gamut Works, which is a gamut visualization tool, and what we're looking at here, let me turn this one off first, this is a volume representation of the sRGB color space rendered in a color space, an objective color space called CIE-LAB. What this shows is the volume of color in that objective three-dimensional color space that a particular device, in this case an sRGB monitor, can display. Now, in digital photography these days, there are a lot of people using, for instance, Adobe RGB, which
Now, what can the human eye see? If you had the human eye rendered there, what would that look like?
Well, the entire lab space falls within the adapted state of the human visual system.
Okay.
I have a slide here that talks a little bit about the human visual system's adaptive range, and I'll put that up over here.
Okay.
I hope. Yes. Okay. So. The eye can adapt across a range of 8 to 10 orders of magnitude, from very, very faint starlight to bright sunlight.
Right.
And within that total range, the human visual system can resolve about 100 steps. And that 100 steps, if you're out in bright sunlight, then you can see 100 steps up in this range. Whereas if you're in starlight, you can see, and this corresponds to your experience of walking. If you walk out into bright sunlight, you're dazzled and you can't resolve detail because you're still in the process of adapting up to that portion of the intensity range.
Right.
So any of these, for instance, sRGB has a range that's approximately the same as the human adapted the range of an adapted human visual system, but it can't encompass all of this at the same time, right?
Right.
So one of the things that we've done in the Windows Color System is to provide a newer, larger dynamic range, larger gamut color space for an RGB working space, and that is sCRGB.
Okay.
And back over here. Where in this diagram, if you look at the luminance axis, the vertical axis in this space as being from 0 to 1, sCRGB would be from plus or minus max float or 63 million. It's an enormously larger space than this.
Okay.
So we can accommodate, get back on this slide again. We can accommodate what's called high dynamic range imaging in that space. Current digital cameras can capture a wider adapted range than the human visual system can see at one time.
Right.
So high dynamic range imaging, and same is true of modern video cameras, and in that going forward, that range is going to increase, and eventually, there are cameras now that can capture a high dynamic range image with 9 or 10 orders of magnitude range in it, and then you need to be able to accommodate that through your processing pipeline and be able to render out any particular exposure version of that
right.
you want to use. So that's one of the things that we've enabled in the infrastructure for the Windows Color System. The other important thing to mention about the Windows Color System is that we are in no way abandoning or reducing our support for the ICC-based color management workflows. Any existing code that uses ICC profiles will continue to work exactly the way it did before. You can mix ICC profiles with Windows Color System profiles in color transforms, and that will function as you would expect. And we've actually enhanced the ICM, which is the old Windows color management engine. We've added ICC version 4 support to that and fixed a number of major bugs. So we're continuing our ICC support. The WCS system is there as an infrastructure that will be adopted over time. We're not forcing anyone to adopt it. We're not trying to break anyone's workflow to force them into using it. We believe it provides better results than what you can get out of existing.
For normal photographer, like I'm a photographer at the high end of the amateur scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
What they call prosumer.
Yes.
How do I get better color? What kinds of things should I work on to, and how will Windows Vista help me get better color?
Well, to a certain extent, what we're putting in the Windows Color System in Windows Vista is an infrastructure that will be utilized by applications. Although the picture viewer in Windows Vista will be able to use the Windows Color System for image rendering, and will be able to, for instance, image camera raw files directly.
Okay.
That's something you can't do currently.
I didn't know that. Will it work with all the raw? Because there's not just one raw, right?
It's a plug-in raw. The raw formats are proprietary, as you're probably aware. Nikon and Canon and everyone else have their own raw formats. And rather than try to persuade our partners to adopt a common raw format, they all believe they have proprietary value in their own formats. What we've done, the Wind Codex system and the Windows Picture Image Viewer for Vista have done is to put in a plug-in architecture that allows the vendors to provide a plug-in that takes their camera raw format and brings it in.
Right. So that's the first trick, is when I'm capturing images with my new Canon SLR or Nikon SLR camera, capture them in RAW?
Yes.
Okay.
That, I mean, that preserves them. I have an example here I can show you on this.
Okay.
In this viewer, for instance, I have an image here that is in those the dots. Well, maybe I can give you a better view here. Let's turn off the picture and turn on the profile for that. That volume there, this inner volume here is Adobe RGB, and the innermost one is sRGB.
Yeah.
And the larger outer volume is Canon camera raw, roughly.
Okay.
Now, it's hard to tell from this view, but if you look at, if we go back to Adobe RGB.
So basically the raw is capturing more form, more color, more data.
It's capturing more color than you can contain in either Adobe RGB or sRGB, and any time you render from that raw space down to a print, the dynamic range of a print, for instance, or to view it on a display, you're making some compromise about what range of that raw. So the idea is to photograph in raw and preserve that.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, that's your real original, and you're basically doing renderings out of that.
Yeah. Now, if I switch to JPEG is actually throwing away some of the color and some of the detail information.
And one of the things I can show you with this viewer is that if you look at
so invest in some memory cards.
These things get big.
Yeah.
If you look at Adobe RGB, which is a recommended working space in a lot of photographic workflows because it is larger than sRGB and has this much nicer green lobe out here in the color space. Let me explain what I'm doing here. This disk is a slice through the space, and you can see that slice over here.
Oh, wow.
So this outer boundary is the boundary of the Adobe RGB gamut at that level. Now, watch what happens as I run this slice up. We get to where we're getting out into this extreme green lobe here. You'll notice that gamut boundary is clipping against the edge of the CIE lab space. What that means is that if you process Adobe RGB images, Adobe RGB images, which are not nearly as big as a camera raw space, if you process those through an ICC pipeline where they go through the lab PCS, you will of necessity clip colors that are out in that area. Now, admittedly, that's a really bright saturated green out there. It's not a color you encounter in the real world very often, but it is something that photographers should know about, that they, you know, that's one of the reasons that we, in the Windows color system, rather than go through what's called a profile connection space, the ICC defines an intermediate exchange space that's an idealized reflection print. What we use in the Windows color system is what's called a color appearance model, which basically models what the human visual system can see in a particular state of adaptation under particular viewing conditions.
Yeah.
And rather than mapping from one device through this profile connection space, which is relatively small because it looks like a printer gamut, to the destination device space, we're able to map directly from a source gamut to a destination gamut in this color appearance model space and not have that bottleneck. So we can preserve high dynamic range, wide gamut data through the pipeline.
Interesting.
Now, I mean, one thing I just wanted to ask is, I mean, we've been going around and seeing a bunch of XPS kind of folk,
yes.
You know, and one of the core themes there has been fidelity and sort of maintaining that kind of stuff.
Yes.
How much of this kind of applies in the XPS space? I mean, can XPS handle anything other than sRGB?
Oh, yes. XPS can handle sCRGB data, and anything that can be tagged with profiles can go into XPS. Another interesting thing that I don't know if you've spoken about the print ticket print capabilities. It's part of the new printer driver architecture, and what it does is it allows applications and drivers to unambiguously decide who's doing the color management, so you don't have it done twice, which is a common problem today. So
right.
As we get applications and drivers on board that are using this print ticket, print capabilities mechanism, then we can unambiguously determine who's doing it and only do it once.
Right.
And that'll solve a lot of problems for end users and prosumers and professionals.
Excellent.
Awesome. So I'm going to ask one question before you finish, which is, what's with all the cups in the corner?
I have to
That's a hard orange to resolve.
I'll bet that's out of gamut for sure. These cups belonged to my office mate here, Dennis. And the story is that this is something like he's been saving every cup he's used since he's been at Microsoft. I disavow all knowledge to anything to do with that.
And he's still sharing an office. How high do they have to be before he gets his own office?
Well, I've been here 2 years into December.
Right.
I had my own office for a while, but then they moved more people into this building, and it's strictly on how long you've been with the company.
Right. Right.
So,
What was your experience before you came here?
I was with Aldus and Adobe for 15 years. So. Before I joined Microsoft, and I did color management work at Aldus and Adobe as well.
Wow. So you know a little bit about the topic.
I've been at it for a while, and I was the Aldus and for at sometimes the Adobe representative to the ICC.
How does what we're doing in the printer division, how does that compare to the other kinds of printing that are available on old or on other platforms since you've been around and seen it all?
What we're doing in Vista and with the new printer architecture and the Windows color system is very cutting edge and unique. What has worked in the past, in particular on Windows, was there was the sRGB standard color space, which basically emulated the gamut of a common CRT, and most printers that were available early on had gamuts that were comfortably within that. Nowadays, a lot of printers, but any of the new Canon, Epson, or Xerox, HP photo printers have larger gamuts than sRGB already. So, where workflows that succeeded in the past using just the standard, assuming all RGB was sRGB, will no longer provide you with the best output from those devices. So, we've implemented the Windows color system
much better. So we're going to get a lot better photo prints off of Windows Vista.
That's part of what we're working on, yes.
Thanks for showing us around. We're almost out of tape.
Well, that
sort of nails it, right?
Yeah,
Thank you very much for showing us a little bit of your world.
Okay. Well, you're welcome. Thanks for coming by.
All right.